Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Benjamin Rush wore many hats over the course of his 67 years. He became America's leading, most influential physician, and he was the young country's first great humanitarian and social reformer. He called for the abolition of slavery, equal rights for women, improved medical care for injured troops, free health care for the poor, slum clearance, citywide sanitation, an end to child labor, free universal public education, humane treatment and therapy for the mentally ill, prison reform, and an end to capital punishment for non-capital crimes. Historian Harlow Giles Unger tells his remarkable life story in a new biography from DeCapo Press called Dr. Benjamin Rush, the Founding Father Who Healed a Wounded Nation. I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Unger to our show now. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor to be with you.
Did I list all the important things he championed during his life?
A small fraction. He is one of the most remarkable of our founding fathers, if in many ways the most important. Washington was unquestionably father of our military and political structure, and Alexander Hamilton fathered our economic structure.
Jefferson was important as well.
To some.
You've written books about pretty much all of those people, yeah. You probably know better than I. President John Adams said, as a man of science, letters, taste, sense, philosophy, patriotism, religion, morality, merit, usefulness, taken all together, Rush has not left his equal in America, nor do I know in the world. So why do you think most Americans aren't even familiar with Dr. Rush, who, as you say, is one of the most notable signers of the Declaration of Independence?
Most Americans aren't familiar with any of the Founding Fathers. In a recent survey of university seniors at the 100 most prestigious universities, according to U.S. News and World Report, the author, historian David McCullough, constructed some of the questions, one of which was, who was the commanding general at Yorktown? And 67% of them, two-thirds of these college seniors from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and all the others, said General Grant.
Oh, boy.
And as David McCullough said, if you don't know Yorktown, you don't know American history. So it's very unlikely that most Americans know anything about Dr. Benjamin Rush and most of the other signers. There were 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. He was the only MD, the only doctor who graduated from medical school to sign that document.
But do you think also his decision not to seek re-election to Congress was a factor? He didn't participate in the Constitutional Convention.
He wasn't interested in a career in politics. He only went to the Continental Congress for the Declaration of Independence because he believed in individual liberty to practice medicine, to run your own business, and of course the others were there for the same reason. But he wasn't interested in a political career. He was interested in healing the sick and treating the wounded. He wanted to be a doctor, and so he set out to treat all of the people in Philadelphia, or as many as he could reach. He was the first doctor to treat the very poor. Most doctors wouldn't treat the poor. They lived in the slums. They smelled. They had to risk being infected by the diseases. So they wouldn't treat the poor, and the poor couldn't pay.
And that includes African Americans.
That included African Americans. It was worse with African Americans. No white doctor, and there only were white doctors, would treat African Americans until Benjamin Rush plunged into the African American sections of town as well as the poor white sections of town to treat the poor for nothing. Risking catching the diseases and all the illnesses that they had. So he really was the first doctor to create a code of ethics and behavior for American physicians. And that code stayed in effect, really, for most American physicians until the beginning of the Second World War. Only then, and now, of course, we know that physicians profit from any drugs they do research for, any instruments they invent. They now take shares of the profits. Rush it was absolutely opposed to doctors profiting from anything they developed for mankind.
He also didn't like patent medicines that included alcohol in them.
Well, all patent medicines did at the time. There were no real drug companies. There were these quacks that went around the country in wagons calling themselves doctor and selling these syrup-flavored rum or white lightning whiskey, which rendered the sick rather insensible, and they'd forget about their pains and illnesses. But in developing his code of ethics for doctors, Benjamin Rush inveighed against the tried to get a law passed against the use of the title doctor to anyone but a graduate of medical school, of a recognized medical school. He failed on that.
He failed on having Philadelphia end slavery.
He failed on, do you realize, 22 states didn't still have slavery on the books. They wiped out all slavery except convict labor. Well, convict labor is forced labor. That is a form of slavery. And 22 states still have that on their as part of their constitutions. Only Rhode Island, of all of the 50 states, has outlawed all forms of slavery in America.
But when you look at the things that Rush fought for, you can either think, well, here's a man who is many, many years ahead of his time, because so many of the things that he fought for are things that weren't resolved for quite a while afterward. But I wonder why he was the only signer of the Declaration of Independence who expressed concern about these things. Or were there others? Ben Franklin?
Well, there were others who mildly supported some of the issues that Rush developed as a social progressive. But remember, almost all of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were the richest white men in America. And the reason they declared independence had nothing to do with individual liberty. It had to do with the fact that suddenly these tax collectors from England were coming over and wanted part of their profits. And they had never done that before. This, to them, this was confiscation. And so that was their primary motive for independence. After the Declaration of Independence and even after the Constitution, blacks couldn't vote. Women couldn't vote.
Well, 90% of the population couldn't vote.
Of course not. And so these were not social liberals.
But do you think that some of that had to do with the fact that when the Constitution was written, a lot was made in deference to the southern states, which had smaller populations than the northern states,
if you don't count the slaves? Of course it was.
And that's the reason for the Electoral College.
But it was also to satisfy the very rich in the North. Remember John Hancock, whose famous signature is at the bottom of the Declaration of Independence. He was among the richest men in America, if not the wealthiest. He was a prominent merchant banker in Boston. All of the goods that farmers bought, they had to buy from Hancock and Company. If they wanted to borrow money, they had to borrow from Hancock and Company. So it wasn't just the southern plantation owners. It was the Philadelphia, New York, and Boston merchant bankers, as they were called. These, all of them put together, with the one exception of Samuel Adams, who was a bankrupt brewer. But with the exception of Samuel,
although his beer is selling well now.
It's not his anymore. It has nothing to do with his original brewery.
I know, I was making a joke.
But except for him and John Adams, who had a small farm but also was a prominent lawyer, but obviously not among the wealthiest men in America, but except for the two of them and maybe two or three others, all of the signers of our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution, all of the signers were the wealthiest white men in America.
Was Rush's family wealthy?
Rush was an exception, but he only signed the Declaration of Independence, as I said, and that was simply because of his love of individual liberty. He went back to practicing medicine. Rush's father-in-law, Richard Stockton, his wife's father, also a signer of the Declaration of Independence, he was indeed wealthy. He had a huge farm in Princeton, New Jersey, and so he was very, very wealthy, and his wealth actually helped sustain Rush's social reform efforts.
Do you think Rush, some of his ideas came from the fact that he was a Quaker whose family history involved an ancestor who fought with Cromwell against King Charles I?
Well, he was interested in Cromwell, but he just simply grew up. His Quaker background, of course, did contribute to his sense of decency and empathy for others, especially the disadvantaged. But his was a personality that developed, undoubtedly under the influence of his parents, as someone who empathized and sympathized with the disadvantaged. And he didn't feel in a country as rich as this, or in England or France, that there should be any disadvantage. There was no reason for it. That the disadvantage was simply people who were exploited by the very rich.
He had spent time in England. He came to medicine somewhat late, having rejected a career in the clergy and then the law. And after he did some medical studies in New Jersey, he went to the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Did that affect his thinking?
Probably not. This was the University of Edinburgh Medical School was the finest medical school in the world. And the people who attended, the men who attended it, were, again, among the most advantaged young men in England, Scotland, in the English-speaking world. So that's unlikely to have influenced him. After he finished his studies there, he went to London and stayed with Benjamin Franklin, became very good friends of Franklin. Franklin became almost a surrogate father, certainly a mentor, and introduced him to the most prominent political leaders, social leaders, and artists, writers of London at that time. He grew close to Hume. He grew close to Benjamin West, the artist, to John Wilkes, the social political leader.
And Catherine Macaulay.
Catherine Macaulay.
Samuel Johnson, you're right.
So Catherine Macaulay, of course, influenced him. He grew close to her and influenced him in favor of women's rights. He was astounded to read her history of England. No woman had ever written such a learned tome before, and he grew very close to her, maintaining correspondence with her after he returned to America.
Also, interestingly, in France, Denis Diderot.
Yes, that was not as close a friendship because they had language difficulties, but Diderot was good friend of Hume's, and Hume could speak French, so that they had a correspondence with each other. And Diderot, after visiting Diderot asked him to take some letters back to Hume.
He argued that it was essential that our ladies obtain a suitable education, and dismissed objections to education of women as the prejudice of little minds. He called for equal rights for women under the law. Did he believe women should be allowed to vote as well?
Absolutely.
And that's in a time when 90% of the population couldn't vote.
Right. One of the interesting things about Rush, he didn't want to be a politician, but he learned politics in a sense. He knew he could not get women's rights through the Pennsylvania legislature or the U.S. Congresses. So with each advance that he pushed, tried to push through the legislatures, he tried to show them how their areas there and they themselves would profit. So in pushing for women's rights and women's education, he didn't push the idea, equal rights. He pushed the idea that who is the first teacher of your children? Do you want your sons to grow up ignorant, or do you want them to grow rich and famous like you? And who are the first teachers? Well, the first teachers are your wives, their mothers. How can they teach your children to become leaders if they are uneducated? They need to study history and literature and all of the same things you said.
Well, convincing argument, but it didn't work.
Well, it did and it didn't. Women's education did begin on a limited level at what we would call today the primary school level, in terms of the curriculum, not in terms of their ages. But they did start going to school in Philadelphia.
My guest on today's London Lopate at Large is Harlow Giles Unger, whose latest book, he's written many books about the important figures during revolutionary times and the years that followed. His latest book is Dr. Benjamin Rush, the Founding Father Who Healed a Wounded Nation. As you pointed out, he was a doctor. How did he come to even be one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence?
Well, as I said, he believed in individual liberty.
But did he appoint, self-appoint, or was he invited?
He was elected.
Uh-huh.
Well, most of the members of the Continental Congress were elected by a limited number, obviously, but by their constituents to go to Philadelphia. And he was elected by his constituents, obviously his wealthy ones, in Philadelphia.
Although Philadelphia had the largest percentage of loyalists in the colonies, probably because they had the most to lose if there was independence.
Well, Philadelphia at the time, most people don't realize it, Philadelphia at the time was the cultural, economic, and political center of the Americas. Of the colony, of the colonial America, so that you had all of these great minds there, so many involved in banking that there were rural uprisings in western, what is now central Pennsylvania, but was not then western Pennsylvania. The farmers felt that the bankers were controlling all of the Philadelphia's politics. And they were. The farmers were absolutely right.
What role did Rush play in helping shape Thomas Paine's writing of Common Sense?
Well, that's kind of a mystery. They did meet, no question about it, when Thomas Paine first arrived there and was looking for work. And he was a writer, a polemicist already. And they met in a bookstore. Now, remember, Philadelphia was a relatively small city, even though it was the largest in America. It was only 2 miles in diameter, so you could walk from one end to the other easily. And it was a doorstep social situation where people would be on their doorsteps and you'd stop and chat and meet each other. So the prominent people all knew each other. And in this bookshop, the two of them met. They started discussing their common interests in literature. And Rush supposedly told Paine of his interest in independence. Well, that Paine was deeply interested in independence. He was a friend of John Wilkes in London. And by independence, I mean the overthrow of royal rule, not necessarily national independence. As Paine said in his famous essay, Common Sense, that it doesn't make sense that someone should rule over us just because he was born to a certain mother. So the two of them got along famously, and Rush said he was starting to, according to Rush's diary or autobiography, which was written 30 years later, according to his recollection of their meeting, he told Paine that he was thinking of writing a polemical essay on independence and an end to royal rule. He told Paine that I really can't afford to do it. I'd be ostracized by most of my patients. Why don't you do it? Paine said he would, and according to Rush, Paine kept bringing drafts of his Common Sense to Rush to review and edit. And when he came up with a title, Rush, according to Rush's autobiography, said, instead of that, why don't you call it Common Sense? And that this is according to Rush's autobiography. We have no way of clarifying it. Payne did not keep a diary of those days, so we really don't know the truth
of
that story.
It was a good title.
Yeah, it certainly sounds good.
Did Rush fight in the American Revolutionary War?
No.
He was a field surgeon.
Well, what he did after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, he wanted to join the Revolution. Men were dying. And so he galloped out of Philadelphia up to join Washington, who by then had retreated after these humiliating defeats in New York, had retreated across New Jersey and across the Delaware, and was camped on the banks of the Delaware opposite Trenton. When Rush came in,
And Trenton is just across the river from Philadelphia, so it was...
No, it's north of Philadelphia.
I mean, but it's not that far.
There was nothing. It's about 30, 35 miles. At any rate, after the troops crossed the Delaware and went into Trenton, the Battle of Trenton, he joined the tail end of the troops, went with them. He had no arms. He would not fire a gun. It was against his religious beliefs. But he went into battle, not to fire bullets, but to try to heal the wounded. And he was the first doctor in history to do so.
Armies had traditionally left wounded soldiers to die, so he was...
Well, there was nothing to prevent them from dying, because there were no antiseptics, there were no antibiotics. So when you were injured in peace as well as war, you were badly injured, you would die within a few days.
So what could he do?
Septicemia. Not much. He did try to clean the wounds. He did manage to save more than would normally have been saved. He railed at Washington, saying, I need a hospital. So Washington finally yielded and had his troops seize a house on the edge of the battlefield that Rush turned into a field hospital. And he managed to save a few lives and certainly to try to treat the wounded as best as he could. The one thing everyone has to remember when they read about medical care before 1850, there was no medical care. Scientists and doctors knew nothing about treating the ill or the injured. They did their best. They tried to use old-fashioned remedies. They knew that giving a drink of whiskey kind of put the people a little bit under, but amputations were done. Especially the officers were given rum to knock them out, but the enlisted men were simply given a piece of wood to bite on, and amputations and things like that were done without any anesthetic. Usually the patient would pass out after a couple of minutes, but it was painful. It was horrible, and
he
largely useless.
He criticized, I'm quoting, the ignorance, cowardice, and idleness, and the drunkenness of our major generals, and said they didn't care for the wounded, and that must have made him some powerful enemies.
It did, but he didn't care about that. First of all, he had so many friends in the Pennsylvania legislature and in the Continental Congress.
He was one of the signers.
He was a popular man. He had a wonderful personality. When the first Continental Congress, when these people all came out from out of town, he jumped into one of the carriages, and there were John and Sam Adams, and he started talking to them, and invited them to stay at his house. So the two Adams cousins stayed with Benjamin Rush. During the Congresses when they were in Philadelphia, most of the signers stayed in taverns. The Adamses were very comfortable, and he made friends with all of these people. Adams became one of his best friends throughout his life. He had a marvelous, winning personality. They trusted him. They all went to him. He was the only doctor they knew, so they were visitors from out of town. They automatically went to him when they were sick. And after he had finished his political career while he was a doctor, he would walk in and out of the Pennsylvania State Legislature or in the Congress and just shake hands with everybody and start lobbying them for one of his political issues.
He wrote a pamphlet that said guidelines for keeping the soldiers healthy. with routines of diet and cleanliness. Now, he could have called everything he did common sense.
Well, yeah, exactly. Cutting off the hair, cutting their hair very, very closely to try to prevent lice, keeping clean, washing your clothes, bathing two or three times a week to try to get rid of the vermin on your body. Now, he was in the forefront. He proposed things in the care of the human body that were a century ahead of himself. And, of course, the most prominent area being in mental health.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But sticking to this, was he really the founder of the Army Medical Corps?
Yes. In effect, mm-hmm. the other doctors, when they saw the favor he was winning with Washington, started rallying about and coming along and contributing their efforts. But none of them ever went into battle the way Rush did at Trenton and later at Brandywine. At Brandywine, he even treated some British wounded British soldiers, so much so that the officers gave him free passage across into enemy lines. And he was admired by both the British and American military command.
So you were about to say that he pioneered the treatment of mental illness as a disease a century before Freud.
When he joined Philadelphia Hospital, he accidentally wandered into a basement area where he found dozens of men and women chained to the walls, naked, moaning and groaning, many of them covered with sores, half starved to death. He was absolutely appalled. At first he thought it was a prison cell of some sort, prison area, and he went tearing into the hospital director's office, demanding to know what was going on.
Wasn't it believed at the time that people with mental illness were impervious to cold or heat? And that was...
Well, there were all sorts of things.
That is quite convenient, obviously.
The principle was the mentally ill were mentally ill because they were... the devil, Satan, had made them so, that this was a spell cast by the devil. So it didn't make... The details of it are unimportant. Superstition surrounded their treatment. And he demanded that they be released, that they be placed into clean hospital rooms with furnishings. And to do so, he had to accept custody of these first patients himself. So he now was responsible for them. And he started talking to them, learning their interests and developing various therapies, physical therapy for one, with exercise to get them healthy and strong again.
But also talk therapy before Freud? Occupational therapy?
Occupational therapy came next. And in talking to them, he let them talk back. And little by little, he developed what he called talk therapy, which is what we now call psychotherapy. And this is 50 years before Freud was even born, 100 years before he came up with his now disproven theory of psychoanalysis. Psychotherapy is now the standard treatment for the mentally ill all over the world.
And Rush's image is on the seal of the American Psychiatric Association.
The American Psychiatric Association.
So he's been called the father of American psychiatry?
The American Psychiatric Association put a bronze plaque on his grave calling him the father of American psychiatry.
He also argued that both mental illness and addiction, which at that time was mostly alcoholism, were medical problems. It's interesting, that matter is still being debated in some circles today.
Absolutely. He was the first doctor to call for abstinence with alcohol, and he opposed the first doctor to oppose the use of tobacco long before the Surgeon General of the United States. So he was ahead of his time in so many areas, and it was all instinct his instinct. He had no way of providing scientific proof for all of these things he counseled. It was his personality and his deep belief in his theories of medical and mental treatments.
Well, how was he able to get funding for having these people released from prison dungeons and put in hospitals?
Again, his personality. He won over friends in the field of education, for example. He became very good friends with wealthy people in Philadelphia, and he was able to raise the funds for Dickinson University. Dickinson was governor and a prominent Quaker. So Rush founded Dickinson University, called it Dickinson rather than Rush University because Dickinson was governor, and it talked Dickinson into giving his wife into giving their huge library to the college. Then he lobbied for and helped found Franklin College,
which is now Franklin and Marshall.
Now Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. And again, he lobbied by showing how it was in the interests of the political leaders, because this huge population in and around Lancaster, mostly German-speaking, growing up illiterate, unable to vote. You'll get their vote if you found this college and teach them to read and write English.
Again, being sensible, but not necessarily listened to, because that went against everything, the conventional wisdom of the time. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large, Harlow Giles Unger, who has told the remarkable story of Benjamin Rush, Dr. Benjamin Rush, in a new book from DiCapo called Dr. Benjamin Rush, the Founding Father Who Healed a Wounded Nation. How many books have you written so far?
That have actually appeared, 26.
Oh, my.
The Rush book, about 26. The 27th is already written. That will come out next year on Thomas Paine. And I'm working on the 28th at this point.
Oh, so, but all of them are either set in the 18th or early 19th centuries.
Right. These are all of the greatest men in American history whose names are no longer recognized by the American people because of the decline in the teaching of American history and decline in the quality of public school education generally, so much so that, I mean, we have three states that have already cut back on public school education 4 days a week instead of five, and a fourth state that's going to vote on it soon. So Americans just don't seem to care about our history.
But you've done this almost as a hobby, because you've also worked as a journalist for when the New York Herald Tribune was in Paris, also in Britain and Canada, done some radio commentary, and taught in universities.
History is history is history, like Gertrude Stein's "Roses are Roses are Rose," and good journalism is history. Tomorrow it becomes history. Today's news. So all of this is an effort to teach Americans the history of their nation and of the most important people in the history of the nation, those who founded this nation. It's a remarkable nation, the first of its kind in the history of the world.
You mentioned that he started a number of schools, but some schools have been named after him as well, medical schools.
In Chicago, they have a huge medical center, the Rush University Medical School, a nursing school. It's a huge scientific complex in Chicago. Why Chicago? Rush, of course, had nothing to do with Chicago, but obviously those who founded the Rush complex in Chicago admired this man and what he contributed to this nation's founding.
And you said earlier that he was able to routinely walk in and out of the State House in Philadelphia to chat up members of the legislature because he was so respected. But he badgered them to build public schools and hospitals, establish free universal public education, reform state prisons, end capital punishment for non-capital crimes, grant equal rights to women, abolish slavery, ban child labor, and clean city streets regularly to reduce the spread of disease. Now, how many of those things did he actually convince them to do?
Well, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania became the first state in America to abolish slavery. They added that to their constitution, and that was thanks to Rush. So he was partially successful. He was totally successful in certain things, especially where it fulfilled the interests of the legislators. He was partially successful in other areas. And more important, he put a bug in people's minds. He made people begin to think, hey, isn't there something to this? Won't the nation, won't our communities, won't we as a people be better off by doing this? We're still debating many of these issues today, of course. We are a long way from equal rights for all people, regardless of race, creed, color, and gender. Women still aren't on a par with men in terms of their earnings in the same job, doing the same work. So we are still debating the issues that Dr. Benjamin Rush raised, and his influence continues to influence our society.
He wrote a paper early on that was not only against slavery, but specifically talked about being against prejudice in general. But although he called slavery a crime, didn't he own a slave named William Grubber?
Well, he was so appalled by the slave market. He went to the slave market and bought a slave with the purpose of freeing him. So he was going to he was going to trigger emancipation by example. And the boy was about 16 at the time. And like all slaves, and this is one of the things that Americans don't understand about the overall situation of in the period of slavery. Like all slaves, he was newly arrived from Africa. Obviously, no one knew in America knew where. And he was illiterate and unskilled. And one thing that Americans don't realize is that in the early 1600s, there were no slaves. The late 1500s, there were no slaves in America.
They came as indentured servants.
No, England was shipping slaves to the Caribbean Isles, the Sugar Islands, as they were called, to plant and harvest sugarcane, which was done with machetes and was unskilled labor. And you could show them by example how to do it. It was not really skilled labor. Soon the islands became overstocked with the slaves and their children and the elderly. So good Queen Anne, as she was called, started shipping slaves to Virginia. And the plantation owners rebelled in early 1600 and petitioned her to stop. They didn't want these slaves coming over. They were illiterate, as I mentioned. They were unskilled. And they didn't know how to plant, harvest, and cure tobacco. That was a skilled trade. But Queen Anne threatened to send troops if they didn't accept the slaves, so they finally had to. But our founding fathers did not invent slavery. They were the next or second generation afterwards. They didn't. And George Washington, who had more than 300 slaves, was overburdened with them because one-third were elderly and crippled and couldn't work. One-third were babies and couldn't work. So only one-third was able to work. And to free them, and he did in his will, to free them, where would they go in the South? The road out of one plantation led to the road into the next. There were no towns and cities in the South. No place to go. So tell all these mothers with their babies, you're free. Now, where could they possibly go?
Rush preached the reciprocal influence of the body and mind upon each other. So was he also the father of behavioral medicine?
Behavioral medicine and psychosomatic medicine. This was part of his studies in mental mental illnesses. He noticed that some people seemed sick, but there was nothing wrong with them, and that their moods could create certain types of illness. So he developed what we now call psychosomatic medicine.
And he was a strong advocate of hospital hygiene. So in the end, how much of an impact did Rush have on American medicine? Would you say that his contributions to politics and society were as important as his contributions to medicine?
They were part and parcel of the same thing, because, after all, what do we do with a person who's sick today, really terribly ill, and we don't know what's wrong with them? You know, we don't know what's wrong with half the people who are sick in hospitals. Well, we clean them up, we feed them properly, put them on a proper diet, and then conduct all the investigations. That's all he really invented in modern medicine. They had no tools, and they didn't have the needle yet that we use for injections. It's called the hollow point needle. That hadn't been invented. The stethoscope hadn't been invented.
But he did introduce an all but painless method for inoculating patients against smallpox.
Well, he didn't. That was developed in England. But he read the studies and immediately realized it was very important. It wasn't painless. It had nothing to do with painless. It just was less painful than taking cow's serum and cutting open the arm with a lancet and implanting the stuff.
He also began practice in, joined by other physicians, in founding Society for Treating the Poor Gratis. Patients were treated in what's now Independence Hall.
That was part and parcel of his work with poor people.
And President Trump might have appreciated that Rush advocated a nice round of golf, a game that he claimed would allow its player to live 10 years longer. But let's address some of the negatives here, because we've been praising this man so completely. Some of his medical practices are horrifying today. Like most of the leading physicians of his time. He believed that the ancient Greek theory that by ridding the digestive system of all of its contents and letting a large amount of blood flow from the patient's veins, the poisons that were infecting the patient would flow out as well, bleeding them 3 times a day, 20 ounces or less, 100 ounces every 5 days.
Yeah, this wasn't just Rush. This is what everybody believed. Doctors and patients, people believed that, and this goes back to ancient Greece, and they had no other way of finding out that it wasn't true. They had no way of science was in its infancy. It didn't even exist. They believed that diseases were carried in bad air, and you inhaled the air, and that then got into the body fluids. Well, how do you get rid of it? Get rid of the body fluids. It was easy to do with the gut, laxative. Rush's laxatives were so powerful they were called Rush's thunderbolts. You can use your imagination on that one. So that empties the gut. How do you empty the bloodstream? Well, you can't empty it. You kill the patient. They go into shock. So the doctor, Rush, and people, the responsible doctors would take a maximum of 10 ounces of blood a day. What they didn't realize was that the body itself puts that all back in 24 hours. It regenerates that amount of plasma in 24 hours. Then another 10 ounces the next day. Well, the bleeding, if they exceeded 10 ounces, they went to 15 or 20, the patient would get a little woozy, less sensitive to pain, feeling a little bit better. And now you've got this founding father, this great man standing over you. You should feel better now. And that puts even more into the patient's mind, and they feel better. If they got well, it means they would have gotten well anyway. They got well in spite of the bleeding. If they died, they died because of the disease, not because. As it turned out, Washington died of overbleeding, and it was his fault, although
You mean it was Washington's fault?
It was Washington's fault. He called, there was no doctor around. He called for his plantation manager to come and bleed him. Remember, bleeding was done with a knife called a lancet that cut in through the skin and then into the vein. They had no needles then for that. So he was bled. He didn't feel better. Meanwhile, Martha had called four doctors. Doctors come in, and they say, well, let's bleed him again.
Oops, you didn't turn off your phone.
Sorry.
Anyway, so another thing he did, a treatment for the gout, they cut off into the foot to drain off water. During this time, we had the yellow fever epidemic of 1793 that claimed 5,000 lives in a city of about 50,000 people. And isn't it likely that his employment of purge and bleed treatments killed as many patients as he saved during that time?
Probably. There's no way of telling how many. Those who survived his treatments obviously either would have survived. You can survive yellow fever without any treatment. Just getting better. So some did have yellow fever and survived despite the bleeding. Some didn't have yellow fever and survived whatever they had despite the bleeding. The bleeding did nothing, but it was the only treatment. So therefore, he and other doctors who used the same treatment said it was the bleeding. If the patient survived, it was because of the bleeding.
When a critic accused him of causing unnecessary deaths, didn't he sue for libel?
Yes. He was astounded. He believed deeply that God had placed him on earth to heal the sick and the injured. He felt almost like a saint, and others treated him that way. And this unscrupulous journalist who hated everything American, as an English journalist, bitter over the loss of the United States, he called Rush every name in the book in his newspaper, a leech, a devil, everything. And Rush was deeply hurt by it. Friends urged him to sue this fellow, to put this fellow in his place. He did, and he won the case. And it remains one of the great cases, one of the landmark cases in libel law. He won $5,000, which he gave to charity, but he came out of there shaken, man.
But he probably did cause some unnecessary deaths.
But he didn't know that.
No.
There was no way for him or anyone else to know that. That's the problem with history. When read in modern times, you think, well, why didn't they? They couldn't. They didn't have the knowledge. It's interesting, a book written by a prominent physician about 2-3 years ago, just as I was working on the Rush book, came out. And his estimate and the estimate of a group of scientists is that 50% of the illnesses today they know nothing about.
And even today,
most people think medicine is a science, and it's not. It's an art.
Over the years, Rush wrote a 4-volume work on medicine.
A massive 4-volume work that became.
How much of this is it would make any sense today?
Oh, a lot of it. Some of it's just common sense. It deals with hygiene and things like that. Obviously, it also proposes bleeding for many diseases. That doesn't make any sense. And it lasted, it was used as the basic text in medical schools in this country until the Civil War. He also wrote a text on psychiatry, which was used as the text in medical schools until the end of the 19th century. It lasted for 100 years as the definitive text. He brought together everything they knew. This wasn't all stuff that he made up in both his medical text and the psychiatric text. This was all of the knowledge of the world at that time.
When he died in 1813 at the age of 67, wasn't his funeral a major event?
Yes and no.
Well, a newspaper described it as second only to the burials of George Washington and Benjamin Franklin.
Well, he was a beloved man.
Oops.
He was a beloved figure by then. The problem in some of the eulogies is they reached into the future and predicted that many of the things that Rush, in quotes, discovered would change the face of medicine. Of course, they didn't. This was a primitive form of medicine, and people quickly forgot about him, except for the American Psychiatric Association, and oddly enough, the American Veterinary Medicine.
Did he also do veterinary?
He invented it in this country. He was the
why not?
He was the father. It had been invented in France about 50 years earlier. To try to stop a cattle plague, and it continued and grew in terms of taking care of domestic animals, and farmers found that they profited by taking care of the domestic animals instead of just putting them down whenever they were sick. Other nations followed suit in Western Europe, and when Rush was a student and visited Paris, he visited that school, came back and talked Washington into trying to start one here. No one would listen to them. Washington was a great farmer, a great agricultural scientist in his own right, and he believed everything Rush said about taking care of domestic animals. Rush wrote the definitive article, big thick pamphlet, on taking care of domestic animals, and no one believed him. They didn't start the first veterinary school. Medicine didn't start until 40 years at the University of Pennsylvania. But he showed the uses of domestic animals. The oxen plows our fields. The horse not only carries our vegetables to market. The horse promotes democracy by carrying people to the polls to vote. It promotes friendship by carrying people to neighbors' houses that are too far to walk. Cows supply skins for our shoes, our book covers, all sorts of things, besides milk, cream, butter, and cheese. So there were all of these advantages that he pointed, economic advantages to taking care of these animals, plus all of these domestic animals put together lay their droppings across the fields and fertilize our fields so the things grow. So take care of your animals, for goodness sake. And he won a lot of converts with that pamphlet, but none of the universities were willing to set up a school of veterinary medicine for another 50 years until University of Pennsylvania finally did.
You put the blame on us not knowing much about people like Dr. Benjamin Rush on contemporary American education, but when I brought up his name with people a lot older, only a few recognize it, and generally it was because they had some reason to, because they either had studied medicine or knew something about veterinary medicine or whatever, so they had heard his name over the years.
Well, and so did I from my father's generation, but the point is today's younger generation, today's doctors coming out of medical school, I guarantee you they haven't heard of Benjamin Rush, whereas my father's generation, at the beginning of the 20th century, middle of the 20th century, all knew Benjamin Rush's name and cited him largely for the medical the code of ethics.
Well, we have just scratched the surface in this conversation. If people want to know more, the book by Harlow Giles Unger is Dr. Benjamin Rush, the Founding Father Who Healed a Wounded Nation. It's published by DeCapo Press. And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Harlow Giles Unger, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.